It was not lost on me that this week the Rabbona Shalom orchestrated it such that I would be preparing today's presentation about the perspective of Chaim Hazaz. Chaim Hazaz, a great literary giant of modern Israel. We'll talk about him in a minute. And the fact that it is the week of Yom HaTzmaut, Yom HaZikaron, it's an opportunity for us to take an important look at the relationship between Judaism, Yadus, and Zionism, Tzionut. That's going to be our focus today, thinking about Judaism and Zionism. And we're going to do that by thinking about the letter that Chaim Hazaz wrote to David Ben-Gurion. That's one piece of this, but also through the very important short story, this famous work that Chaim Hazaz did called Hadrasha, which I shared in the email. And if you did not take a look at it yet, you could Google it online. The Tikva Fund has a Xerox of it. There are other places to get it, or you can email me afterwards, rbrand@torahchicago.org. Chaim Hazaz's work, short story, 10 pages, not long, Hadrasha, which we'll talk about in a little bit. So first of all, for those who are now in person, you can see for the first time what book I have been using this year, right? We haven't even seen each other since the beginning of this Shir series. So this is the copy, my copy of Mi Yehudi that I've been using all year that I've been scanning for you. I picked it up at a used book sale from the JCT, which is the Jerusalem Torah College. They were selling it for like 5 shekel, and you can see it's proved very worthwhile. And then at home I have the English copy. But this is, like you've been wondering what's been going on behind the screen, this is what it is. This original copy that's, you see exactly what condition it's in. It's great, it's perfect. So Chaim Hazaz, his letter appears here in my edition on page 12. And it's a one-pager which you have in front of you. Chaim Hazaz, writing to David Ben-Gurion, one of Israel's greatest authors of all time. And he was the first laureate of the Israel Prize of Literature in 1953. That's when they started the Israel Prize, which, as you know, is Israel's most prominent recognition. So Chaim Hazaz was the first winner of the Israel Prize in literature. He came from Russia. He was born in Russia in 1898. And in wake of the revolution, he made his way to Turkey, and ultimately he made his way to Paris. He spent 9 years, I think 9 years in Paris. And he was recognized as a gifted literary, I don't want to say genius, but an incredibly accomplished literary expert. Now remember, he grew up in a traditional, think about this, he grew up in a traditional Jewish Torah milieu in Russia, like many at the turn of the century, and then ended up in Paris in a secular context. And so he's one of these figures who we've reflected on in the past is a transitional person, and represents this movement from Eastern European Jewry, ultimately to, where does he move in the 1930s? In 1931, he moves to what that time was Palestine. So he's moving to Palestine in 1931, but he's had this background of experience with Jewish life in Russia, where you had, of course, all of the pogroms and everything else that goes with that. And then you've got the piece of moving to Israel with that interim piece in Paris where he's experiencing the world culture. So he's one of these transitional figures, and he represents a slice of history that maybe you could argue was the focus of Rav Kook's work. Rav Kook wrote an important monograph called Ma'amar Hador, The Topic of the Generation. And he's describing the intellectual ferment which is taking place at this time at the turn of the 20th century with movements about Marxism and communism and socialism and the social upheaval and the intellectual upheaval. And we've talked already in the past about similar figures to this, although he later became much more observant, Shai Agnon. But Agnon, similar kind of path. Eastern Europe, makes his way to Israel, prolific author, creative spirit, went on an interesting spiritual journey. These people are living at a really interesting time. So Rav Kook addresses this and the whole nature of their tumultuous searching, which I think is part of what's going to come out today, where we're going to end, which is that there is an angst here. There is a feeling that's going to be a part of this discussion. Sure,
so how
question.
Old was he when he went to Israel?
He was born in 18... How old was he?
1898.
He was born in 1898, so he's 33 years old.
And his Hebrew was this good to...
So he... Exactly, so... Like many other in the world of the Haskalah, so they were studying Hebrew already back in Russia. Like many other, you know, by the end of the 20th century, the movement for the Haskalah, for enlightenment, you could call it, but it meant general education and education in Hebrew, modern Hebrew, right? This, which was a product of Ben Yehuda's revival of the language, and then it spread. And by this time, by the 1900s, there are periodicals that are being published in Hebrew in Europe, secular Hebrew periodicals, as part of the confluence of the Enlightenment, the Haskalah, which has grown over time, and the movement of Zionism, which was primarily secular. Yes, there were the Chovav Eitz Zion and some Rabbanim, but it was primarily secular. So he moves to Israel, and for 16 years, he actually moved around in different neighborhoods in Yerushalayim, so he had the opportunity to experience and interact with different cultures within Yerushalayim. And as we know, there are lots of different characters of these different neighborhoods respectively. And one of the places that he spent a lot of time was with Yemenite Jews. Yemenite Jews. So you have this immigrant from Russia who had been in Paris, who's now living with Yemenite Jews, and so that pervades some of his writings later on, a very interesting picture of what he's seeing and experiencing in the Jewish world far beyond his small Russian shtetl. Ultimately, he settles, he gets married in the 1950s, I forget when he gets married, maybe 1940s, he marries a woman who becomes like his co-publisher. She takes care of all of his works. He dies in 1973. She outlives him and establishes this Chaim Hazaz Foundation, which I sent out in the email. You can go online. You can see pictures of his apartment. They set up a fund. So there is a conference that takes place there, and they have tours if you want to go visit his house and his works and things that are published. But that's kind of the arc of his life. He dies in 1973. But here we are in 1958 when he's writing this letter to Ben-Gurion about the question of what to do with the intermarried spouses and their children and how we register people in the state of Israel. So to appreciate this, I want to focus on his work, a short story, which is published in 1952. So let's focus on now Hadrasha. Because this short story of Chaim Hazaz is going to bring into sharp focus how we think about the relationship between Judaism and Zionism. And this is the right time to do it, the week of Yom HaTzmaut, of Yom HaZikaron. And think about his biography as someone who grew up in a cultural milieu that was suffused with Judaism in Russia, and then ultimately migrates into a secular context in modern Israel with that period in Paris. So he writes Hadrasha, and he publishes it in 1942. Now, it's interesting that he publishes it in 1942, meaning it's before the founding of the State of Israel. That's number one. And number two is that it's also pre-full awareness of the Holocaust. So you wonder how he would have written this story if the Holocaust had already been fully known what was going on. But he writes this drasha, this short story called Hadrasha, the sermon, which is written in Hebrew. You can find it online. You also have the English in your email. He puts the entire context of the story at a meeting of a group of men members of the Haganah. What is the Haganah? Anybody know?
Army.
Right? That was the precursor to the IDF, affiliated with Ben-Gurion. You know, there were three main. There was the Haganah, there was the Lehi, there was the Etzel, Palmach. There were groups that were fighting. It was kind of a paramilitary force fighting to drive the British out of Israel to create a state. So the Haganah is the main central branch with tens of thousands of members. There's a meeting. A meeting of the Haganah of a group of men. And their leader calls them to attention at this meeting around a green table. And a man gets up to speak. And his name is Yudka. Yudka is the protagonist of Chaim Hazaz's story. And Yudka says that he has something to tell everyone. And this surprised everybody because Yudka was a man of few words. He was known, and I'm not going to do justice to it because you have the whole story. It's very powerful and it's worth reading. And it generated a ton of discussion. So I'm just going to give you just a cursory summary, but it's kedai to read it. Yudka was a man he describes at the beginning of few words. Yudka didn't speak very much. But he had something to say. So the commander of their group gives him the floor, and he has a few words. So he's shifting, and he's stammering, and he can't really get through what he wants to say, and he keeps getting, you know, distracted a little bit, and he gets interrupted at one point. But the short story in its entirety is Yudka's talk. And it doesn't even finish. It ends while he's still speaking. It just cuts it off. It ends with one of the men. You can imagine these fighters, these immigrants, saying, please don't philosophize anymore. We're not too much philosophy. Because Yudka gives them a philosophical lecture. And he starts by saying that he wants to tell them something important. He tells them that he rejects Jewish history. He rejects Jewish history. And he goes on to explain that he rejects the entirety of the Jewish story until now, which in his view is a story of exile, meaning the last 1900 years, the story of exile. He focuses on three themes: exile, martyrdom, and Messiah. And he starts by being ashamed of and repudiating exile, the Gullus. But not so much the Gullus per se, but the Gullus mentality, the orientation to exile, which he accuses the Jewish people of embracing the exile. And not only that, doing nothing about it, being completely passive, glorifying martyrdom. And he goes on and on talking about, what do we celebrate? We celebrate the fact that we were persecuted and that we were victimized and that we became martyrs. He says, I reject all of this. He suggests that the exile mentality, that gullus orientation, that passivity, he says, it's reprehensible. It's my language, but that's the intensity of which he's speaking. This man who's sweating, who's fumbling for words, but is speaking so passionately. He rejects the fact that people just waited, and this is what transitions him to talk about the theme of Mashiach. Achakelo, I'll wait, and I'll wait longer, and I'll wait longer. And he accuses our history of waiting and doing nothing, just sitting around, being exiled from place to place. And then he says that this whole myth of this belief in Mashiach, that we will one day be saved, but we're not actually doing anything about it, is because Judaism doesn't really want to be saved. Because Judaism cannot exist in a redeemed society of Jews that come back to their land. It won't work. So he goes from talking about the exile to talking about the Mashiach to talking about the modern life in the land of Israel, where he says, just look, where I grew up, says Yudka. Yudka, you could read in between the lines, is growing up in Russia. He's a stone cutter, a mason, some kind of hard laborer. He says, where I grew up, Judaism was thriving, but it was thriving as an exile reality, as a gullus mentality of a bunch of weak, persecuted Jews who didn't stand up for themselves or create anything. He says, but now, look at us. Look around. Look who we are. Look what we're building. 1942, remember, this is being written. And he says, beferish, that Zionism is a negation of everything that came before. It's the anti-Judaism. And he goes on to note how many people are proud of having modern Hebrew names that don't sound Jewish. Because Zionism is not just surpassing Judaism, it's rejecting Judaism. Because Yudka says that Judaism is synonymous with exile, with galus, with passivity, with the fate of drifting among the nations, versus Zionism, which is about building and constructing and about pride. That's the story. It creates a lot of controversy. People start talking in the 1940s and writing and further for over decades. And there's a question. To what extent is this story by Chaim Hazaz reflective of his personal ideology, or is it just something at the time? But I think it's really interesting because this perspective obviously is not just Chaim Hazaz. It's one that many people subscribe to, or we associate many people subscribing to, or at least is the potential to look at the world this way. And I wonder what Chaim Hazaz thinks, but certainly how others think about this exact idea, because when you read what he wrote to Ben Gurion, you get a very similar sounding result. Take a look at the letter that you have in front of you. It was sent in the email last night. Otherwise, I'll read it out. Don't worry. And for those who are here in person, Baruch Hashem, we have good old-fashioned paper. I'm hoping if anybody has not yet gotten vaccines, please let me know afterwards. There are appointments locally. If you don't have a vaccine, Baruch Hashem, here in Chicago, we have lots of access to vaccines. So let me know. I'm really happy to help anybody get a vaccine. And everybody should, in good health, halavai, everybody should be well. I checked with one of our local, I guess, does Ben Katz qualify as the local Tony Fauci? Right? Can we call him our very own Anthony Fauci? Dr. Ben Katz confirmed, as I reached out to him this weekend, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should bless all of us. Everybody should feel safe and healthy, according to the CDC, B'siyata D'shmaya, to be here in person. So next week, Emir Tzashem, you know, whoever's not here yet, I would encourage you, if you are feeling healthy and your doctor says so, come on back, it's beautiful. I mean, the weather's great in here. Anyway, and you could get your own paper to look at. You don't have to print it at home. So he says, hey, David Ben-Gurion, Mar David Ben-Gurion Hayakar, my beloved BG, our Prime Minister, Shkoyach, Ani Moda Lecha, Ala Kovet Shechilakhtali, I appreciate the honor that you gave me. Although I will say, the one thing that the online people have, unless you printed it before, is the English, which I did not print this morning. Oh, okay. Look at the first three-line paragraph after the introduction. He says, you asked me about mi Yehudi. Im la halacha. You see where I am? Second paragraph, the first substantive one. Im la halacha. If you want to ask a shayla about halacha, what does the halacha say about mi Yehudi? Hatshuva bruahi. The answer is clear. Beduko menusa, checked and tested. B'meshech alfei shanim, over years, thousands of years. But now look what he writes. V'im lamaisa,
But if you're asking me about a practical question, hatshuva brurahi, the answer is also clear. He doesn't worry what that is, but kvar garma lo hametzias, but the answer is given by the practicality, shetinasein. Chaval, now look at this last line of the paragraph. Chaval, how do you translate chaval? It's a pity, great, exactly, it's a pity. It's a pity that what? She'i efshar lohashiv al she'ila achas, that you can't answer one question? Shtei tshuvas hasosos zuazu, two answers that conflict. So what's Chaim Hazah saying? That the halacha and the practical state that we find ourselves in 1958 in modern Zionist secular Israel, they are incompatible. Who am I hearing in this letter? I'm hearing the man who grew up in Russia in exile, who comes to Israel, whose name is Yudga, who's telling me that these two cannot coexist. They're irreconcilable. He says, in the past, l'sha'avar, when ad sha'am b'gola, when we were in exile, when we were in exile, lo am ki im kneses Yisrael kilos kodesh mefuzaris ben agolios, we were these holy congregations spread all over. Hayakocha shel hadas yafeh, religion was at its strength. It was good in strength. Lishmor al yichudo ve'al kiyumo halu'umi, to care for our national character. So religion served the function of keeping us with our identity. Bein taim nishtanu azmanim, third line of the third paragraph. Now, times have changed. V'nishtanu kol ha'maisim u'pakru ha'doros v'chur baragolo b'yameinu garam v'hadas ne'ezova. Religion has been abandoned. That's his view. Religion has been abandoned. Hadvarim yiduim, they are known. The Yishuv HaIvri, notice how he doesn't call it Yehudi. Yishuv HaIvri. Yishuv HaIvri, Ba'aretz, in the land, Nitzach es oivav, vanquished its enemies, the Konin es Medidoso, Medinoso, established the Medina, V'lo Konin osa elochulonis, it was established as chiloni, secular. Ve'in sholton ladas, there is no rule of religion. And therefore, he says in the next tiny paragraph, it seems to me, bedati, ki ein la halacha yad, the halacha has no hand, b'mersham atoshavim elo l'chok ha'medina belvad. It's up to the government. The halacha has no place. Because there is a divide. These realms of Judaism and Zionism are distinct, and perhaps one of them has been left in the exile, in the rearview mirror. Now he ends, I'll get you 1 second, he ends with two interesting quirks. I'm not sure how he means. If you look at the second to last paragraph, it's very peculiar. Mikanim rotzim ha'avaim, therefore he thinks, if the parents want, even if the mother, va'im she'ini yudiyah, the mother is not Jewish, lahachnis is benam bevrisa shel Avraham Avinu al menas sheyuchdav yudi mekabla mehem. If you want you, your intermarried couple, to bring your children into lahachnisam bevris shel Avraham Avinu, to enter them into the covenant of Avraham Avinu, to sign them up as Jews, you can. So I'm a little confused, because Chaim Hazah sounds like he's saying that if they want to sign up as Jews, they have to. What does it mean, Lachnis Bevris Shal Avraham Avinu? What does that sound like?
I don't know. Why do we even need that?
What is that? What is he thinking? What do you think he means?
I don't know.
What is that?
I don't know. It's a Chris, but
circumcision. That's what I thought. Then I'm confused. I'm confused by this line.
Yeah.
Why does this intermarried couple need to circumcise their child if he's telling me that the halacha doesn't matter anymore? So that was confusing to me. I was under the impression that when he said that, do you take it to say, I mean, you tell me, what do you think those words mean? If you want to, he's using the language of the bracha, l'achniso b'riso shel Avraham Avinu. That sounds like circumcision to me, which I'm very confused about. Why should they need that? They want to sign up as Jews, sign up whatever you want. So it's strange. That's strange. And then the last line is honestly almost a little bit insulting, where he says, I don't know, ve'eini yodea im imoseim shel kol hager me'ozme olam nizgairu dafka. I don't know if all the converts always converted. Imos imoseim shel shmayav avtalion Rabbi Akiva, the grandmothers of Rabbi Akiva and shmayav avtalion, who all descended from converts, did they all really convert? So that's just a cheap shot. I'm sorry, that's just a cheap shot. I don't know what to say about that. What does that mean? I don't know if they converted. What are you saying? What he's saying is, it's about the national character. And if somebody wants to be part of this nation and contribute to the Zionist enterprise, ma tovu ma naim. Let them join. So how do we think about this, and how do we feel about it? It sounds to me like this is Yudka. This is a man who has gone through a very complicated transformation in his life, and is struggling with many things when he thinks about Judaism and Zionism. Let's go back to Yudka for a second. What is that name? You notice that name? Yudka comes from the name Yehuda. Chaim Hazaz was a brilliant literary mind. The word Yehuda, we are called Yehudim, in which context primarily? It's not for today, but we're called Yehudim, we're called Jews, primarily in Megillas Esther. When you want to think about Jews in an exile context, what keeps us connected to Eretz Yisrael, to the land of Israel, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Ish Yehudi Haya B'Shushan. There was a Jew. Why? Because he's called a Jew since he came from Eretz Yehuda. Asher Hagla Mirushalayim Imagol Asher Haglasa. So he's choosing the name of the protagonist as Yudka. Yudka has this slang. The slang, maybe it's a little bit borrowed from the Russian, or maybe it's a little bit from the modern Zionist. But his name is Yehuda. He's a Jew from the exile who's coming back to Israel now. And he doesn't talk very much. So I saw an interesting article that points out, you know, the Rav, he quotes from the Zohar HaKadosh in an article called Redemption, Prayer, and Talmud Torah, that when we were in Golis, the Zohar says, when we were in Egypt, we had no capacity for speech. Pesach is Pesach, because we were freed. And once we were freed, we have the ability to talk. We have a story to tell. So Yudka comes to the table, this Jew from the exile, he comes to the modern land of Israel, 1942, and he says, I'm not used to talking. Because in exile, we've been mute for all these years. Yeah? To Ha'aras. Yeah, go ahead.
It seems like he's saying that the existing Jew is more like the slave Jew in the triumph. Through Zionism, you can actually return to the neo-Jew, the good free one.
Something like that, maybe. That the original concept of freedom is not going to be found in Judaism, it's going to be found in Zionism. Because look at Judaism. Judaism is synonymous with muteness of exile. Exactly. Now, what he does with the periods of the first bias, second bias, you know, the temple periods where things were great, the Davidic dynasty, that I don't know. But I think that's part of what he's laying. He's a very knowledgeable person in the world of Jewish learning. So he's layering these things in here. Alan, what were we going to say?
What was his personal practice?
I don't get the impression, I don't know, I don't get the impression that he was observant in the way that we would say, or the way that Shai Agnon was. So, for example, Shai Agnon wore a distinguished and very distinctive large black yarmulke when he went to receive the Nobel Prize. You do not see pictures of Chaim Hazaz wearing a head covering. So I'm not going to check his tzitzis. I can't tell you, you know, everybody has their own situation, but he did not seem to be practicing in traditional in that way, although I can't say for sure. I didn't see people who wrote about that. So I think, and who am I, but I think that thinking about his approach is very important. It's very important for us, because there are certain elements of what Yudka is saying, what this letter is conveying, that we agree with. and that we need to remind ourselves. And I think there are certain aspects of it that we reject and we need to call out. Rav Kook describes the Golos, based on the ideas of Chazal, as a long slumber. You know, in the Gemara in Tanis, we speak about people who slept for 70 years. Why they? It's like, the Rip Van Winkle. Why are they sleeping for 70 years? Because 70 years was the initial period of the Golos. So for 1900 years, Rav Kook describes how, as a national entity, we were either asleep, or you could say we were comatose, or dead. And now we're having a Tchias HaMesim. So when Yudka describes that the Golos was something that was terrible, not just terrible from the perspective of suffering, but it was shameful. There's a lot of truth to that. We're not proud of the fact that we've been victimized for 1900 years and that we've been in this spiritual national slumber or comatose state. It's not a source of pride. Oh, good. We're going to get to that for a little bit. We're going to get to that in a little bit. Oh, there were places where we flourished. Great. We'll talk about that in a second. What about the fact that he points out, rightly, that when this state was founded, when Zionism was initiated in the late 19th century, it was primarily secular Jews. And he's right. And Rav Soloveitchik, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik in Kol Dodi Dofeik, says, let us be honest and speak openly and candidly. We are critical, he's talking to religious people. We are critical of certain well-known Israeli leaders because of their attitudes towards to traditional values and religious observance. Our complaints are valid. We have serious accusations to level against the secular leaders of the land of Israel. However, are they alone guilty? While we are as clean and pure as the ministering angels? Such an assumption is completely groundless. We could have extended our influence in shaping the spiritual image of the Yishuv if we had hastened to arouse ourselves from our sleep and descend to open the doors for the beloved, the Ribbono Shel Olam, who was knocking. But we didn't show up. I'm afraid that we, Orthodox Jews, are even today still sunk in a very pleasant slumber. Had we established more religious kibbutzim? Had we built more houses for religious immigrants? Had we created an elaborate and extended system of schools? Our situation would be entirely other than it is. So Yudka is right. Who are the people who are out there? Secular leaders. On the other hand, and I think this is what you're getting to, I disagree with him respectfully on two substantive grounds. The first one is this accusation that during the exile, we were passive. We were not creative. Is that true? Wait a minute. We survived for 1900 years. If all we were the punching bag of history, then why would we still be here? How could we still be here? What does it mean that we're still here? We weren't creative. We continue to exist. Isn't that creative in and of itself? You know, the famous Mark Twain, all the other great empires, even these empires, Rome and Greece, Gornish mit Gornish. You can go see a bunch of stones in Italy. They'll charge you to take you around a half-broken stadium. Nothing left. And we're still here. But I think much more than that, we created, even within the exile, we created, I think, on three levels we can consider, and probably more if we had time to hear everyone. First of all, we created, within that exile experience, communities of values. Kehilos HaKodesh, of values, that lived by values, that created institutions that expressed those values. So, for example, Gemilas Chasadim, kindness, taking care of others, There are, historians have, there are pinkasim. You know what a pinkas is? A pinkas in the time of the Gemara is a ledger. So they had pinkasim, they had ledgers in communities in Eastern Europe. And these pinkasim give us historical records of what went on in these shtetlach and neighborhoods and cities and villages. How much tzedakah was given. How they organized the Gemilas Chasadim societies. What the Chevra Kadisha structure was like. It's documented. Because even though on one hand, from the outside, we were victimized and we were told you can live here and you can't live there. You could do this work and you can't do that work. On the inside, we created societies, communities, and not just Stam communities of survival, but communities that expressed divine, creative values. We created worlds of scholarship. I don't know anything about Christianity. I don't know anything about Catholicism. I don't know if the, do they have Rishonim and Achronim in the Vatican? Like thousands and thousands of pages of brilliant creative scholarship of so many different genres, of responsa, of commentaries, of super commentaries, of biblical exegesis, of halachic interpretation. Like, does that exist in another religion? I don't know. You tell me.
They call them apologies. When you think of the word apologies, they're trying to they rationalize the inconsistencies in the religion. So
that's what it's called?
They have them, but those are called apologies.
That's interesting. I didn't know that. We're not apologizing. We're creating. We're building intellectual worlds. These are live religious experiences that are intellectually creative. So to say that for 1900 years we just sat back and were passive, it was an inner world, even if we couldn't control the outer world. And finally, the inner world goes even more deeply than just the community or the Beis Medrash. It's within Bilvavi Mishkan Evne. It's within the individual. What kind of life did people lead? They may have been impoverished on the outside. My paternal grandfather, Zichron Levracha, came from a shtetl in Galicia called Barnov. So the legend has it that in his neighborhood, before someone died, they would do them a big favor, and they would get them an orange to smell so that they shouldn't leave the world without the hana of smelling an orange in their lifetime. That's how impoverished they were. Do you remember on the corner of Tui and whatever, Sacra Cala Morto, whatever street that is in West Rogers Park? Benny the Barber, Zichron Levracha, Benny Scheinkampf. So I used to go there just to talk to him, to get a bracha. 3 years, the barber in Auschwitz. So before that, he was in Plunsk, which he was very proud of because Ben-Gurion was from Plunsk. So he was a barber in Plunsk. He was 16 years old. So he said, I think they had 9 children. They lived in a one room or, you know, one, like a one, I don't call it one room. I don't know. It was a tiny hut. He said it was a big deal when they had eggs. So what did they have? They didn't have the external luxuries, but they had the internal world. They had fathers and sons, mothers and daughters who sat at a Seder table and had a transcendent conversation. They lit Shabbos candles together. And I'm not romanticizing it to say that it was always perfect. And, you know, yes, there was a woman who lived in Europe who told my father-in-law, she once went for an eye exam, and she said, this was interesting, she said, we hated Yontif in our house in Europe. Why? Because my father and my brothers, this woman said, always went to the Rebbe, and they left us home, and we were home for Yontif all alone, and we were never educated, so we didn't know how to read the Machzor, we didn't have anything to do for 2 days. It's interesting. Interesting. But the creation of spiritually meaningful lives, in otherwise, in the Middle Ages, the Dark Ages, for us it wasn't dark, we had the light of the Ribbono Shel Olam. We had love. We had meaning. People had value. They meant something to the Ribbono Shel Olam. They weren't alone. They certainly weren't lonely. They had kindness. I reflect on these three themes because these we just experienced at the Seder. You notice how the Seder has the community of values, of inviting others, taking care of tzedakah, halach ma'anya. It has an element of Talmud Torah, of Arami Ovidavi, of learning, and it has an element of parents and children connecting over the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and telling the story of our relationship with God. These three things that happen at every Seder, even secular Jews have them at their Seder primarily. We had this for 2,000 years. So there was no creativity, Yudka. There was only passivity, Papitom. There was great creativity. It wasn't out on the battlefield, neither were half of the other populations who were annihilated over the last 2,000 years. But it was an inner strength, a connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's on the one hand. And then the second issue is the notion that Judaism and Zionism are completely distinct and even disjunct from each other, that they can't exist together. I've heard this claim before. The Rosh Yeshiva Zatzal from Keren B'Yavne, where I learned, Rav Chaim Yaakov Goldwicht, has a beautiful essay in light of Sfas Emes, the Heiliges Sfas Emes, based on the Zohar HaKadosh. He says, you know who made this claim? The Meraglim, the spies. The Zohar HaKadosh says, you know why the spies didn't want to go into Israel? Because they were going to lose their position. Sfas Emes explains, doesn't mean that they were power hungry. It meant that their spiritual orientation to life was going to have to change. And that living off of man with Anane HaKavod in the desert carried on the backs of eagles is not going to be the same as moving into a land, plowing, planting, harvesting, taking care of the poor, walking to the Beis HaMikdash, bringing korbanos. Totally different. They said, wait a second. Zionism, what you're telling us, it's going to be Yoshua ben Nun, and what we're experiencing now, Judaism, those don't go together. Going to the land will be a repudiation, a negation of Sinai and connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the Midbar. And the Baruch Hu says, you've missed the whole point. Zionism is not a negation of Judaism. Zionism is the fulfillment of Judaism. The goal is to take all of that communal institutional value of chesed, take care of other people, and all of the learning, and all of the ruchnis, the spirituality that we have inside, and shine the light to the world through a society in a land. That's the goal. Maybe we haven't lived up to that yet. Maybe the Rebbe Shlomo was waiting for us to do that. Maybe it's not perfect. Maybe there are a lot of things that we have to do. But it's not that be'etzem, fundamentally, they are distinct. Adaraba. Maybe it's because we've been sleeping for so long that we've forgotten. We've gotten lost. We don't have the language to come to that vision of elevating all those three levels to their ideal state, where we belong, in a land, with the Beis HaMikdash, with Hashoras HaShechina. That's what Rav Kook describes. And the truth is that maybe he didn't see it in 1942, and maybe it's not perfect in 2021, but what are we seeing? We're seeing a country where you have institutionalized chesed, where they send soldiers, boys and girls, men and women around the world to help people with disasters in all kinds of countries, where you have the largest donor to Talmud Torah in the history of the world. And that is the state of Israel. More money is invested in yeshivas, in kolim, in Benos Yaakov, in people learning Torah now than in the history of humanity. And it's out of the pocket of Medinat Yisrael. And we're seeing the opportunity for people to come back to a land to truly experience that inner spirituality, that third level. What does it mean to stand at the Kotel and Davin? What does it mean to look over the valley where David HaMelech ran, where the Nevi'im spoke, where Avraham Avinu walked? We feel something there. It's not a rejection of the past. It's the sublimation of the past. It's the fulfillment of the dreams of the exile that we waited for because it was out of our control. And we know that the Rebbe Shlomo, in his mysterious ways, has decided this is what it's supposed to be. So I don't agree with Yudka. In some respects I do, but in some respects I don't. And I suspect that Yudka and so many Jews who have this perspective, I think he's hurting. He's crying out. And that's what's really going on here. He's crying out from the pain of exile. He's crying out from the suffering of the exhaustion of Gullus. He's crying out as someone who felt like he's been isolated from traditional Judaism, that maybe from people didn't make him feel welcome. And he's crying out because he feels lonely and solitary. Maybe he's crying out because the only Judaism that he experienced was one that was focusing on Avarachamim and Vehu Racham Yechaper Avon, and how many graves can you dig in a week? And not, you know, I'm trying to think of, you know, Ira's Niggin of V'samachta. V'samachta, you know, the Chabatzker. Right? Not V'samachta B'chagecha. Not an internally rich world. And the Rebbe Shalom is crying with him. Do you know that? The Rebbe Shalom agrees with Yudka. Because the Gemara says in Chagiga Daf Hei, that the Gemara tells us that Rebbe Shalom cries every day. Mipnei ga'avoson shel Yisrael, from the pride of the Jewish people that was taken away from us and given to the exile, to the goyim, to the nations of the world. The Rebbe Shalom cries with him. The Rebbe Shalom hurts like he does. And we also hurt like he does in that way. And so the way that he's expressing this rejection of Judaism, I think it really just comes from a place of godliness, of the divine weeping of HaKadosh Baruch Hu saying, this is terrible, this is broken. But not recognizing that this renaissance of Zionism is a divine gift. It's HaKadosh Baruch Hu's way of saying, you know, I've been crying for so long, let's bring this back. We're living at a time, this week we're going to celebrate Yom HaTzmaut HaBo Aleinu Letova, at a time with the expansion of yeshivas, with the ability to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Mekomos HaKadoshim, with Hesder students who are populating even the highest echelons of the IDF. It's no longer just secular Jews. With hydroponics, where they can make sure that you have lettuce, that you're not going to eat bugs against the values of the Torah. And at the same time, the same people are also making sure that Ethiopians have a place in a Torah society, in a Jewish society. It's slow, but it's coming. It's not perfect. But we're weaning our way out of that exile, and we're making progress to building that vision of the synthesis of Judaism and Zionism. Am I certain about all of this? I'm not certain. Are we certain about anything? But I would say two things in conclusion, and we're way out of time. Number one is that we have a choice. Rav Lau was interviewed last week, Rav Yisrael Meir Lau Shlita, and he was asked about Yom HaShoah and his perspective. And he's talking about how he has a choice of faith. It's an interesting answer, which we're not going to talk about today. But the idea of a choice is also something that Rabbi Sachs, Zichrono Livracha, gave us. We have a choice. Do we want to choose in a world with faith or choose a world without faith? We could choose that. We could choose a world with love or one without. So you could choose a Zionism that is bereft of history, a Zionism that is lacking memory, a Zionism that has no spiritual mooring. You could choose that. Or you could choose a Zionism that has an ark that takes us back to Yetzias Mitzrayim and is part of a continuum of Jewish history and a connection to those who gave their lives and who yearned even if they never stepped foot on the land of Israel. So we have a choice. That's number one, even if we're not certain. And number two is there's a feeling. The wonder of life. The feeling of connection. Is it just another place when we go there? Is it just another country? Or is it something that the Ribbono Shel Olam built within us that we feel a unique connection? Is it something different? Is it disconnected from Jewish history? Or do you feel the living Jewish history as it's being revived in our day? I can't convince Yudka. I'm not going to debate him. Because it's a feeling and it's a choice. But I think it's important that we strengthen for ourselves our own understanding of our relationship, both to Zionism and Judaism in developing our connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu.